In the presentation on special needs ministry, particularly in the area of developmental disabilities, a fundamental piece is identifying the disability itself, although I would have to say that it is probably in the big picture of things the least interesting. There is something far more enticing about the smiles that you encounter in the faces of people with whom you are in ministry. That said, my function here today over the next 15 minutes or so, and I am going to be talking very rapidly, is to set the table a little bit and just give you a bit of information about the disability itself. You should have received when you came in a white sheet of paper with writing on both sides. I'm going to be using that to go through this, so you should have that in front of you. Its purpose is to give you a little bit of information about this particular developmental disability we call mental retardation. Its larger purpose is to drive you toward the undeniable truth that there is nowhere to go if you will not be in the presence of people with developmental disabilities. They are very much a part of our world, a part of our community, and a part of the body of Christ. I'm going to begin on the side of the sheet that starts with the words facts about mental retardation and just buzz down this pretty quickly. Things that are interesting, things that you should know. It is extraordinarily prevalent, far more so than most people realize. About 300 million people in the world have mental retardation. You may be more interested in knowing just about the United States, and in that case, there are about 7 million people in this country who have mental retardation. In terms of comparing it to other disabilities you may be familiar with, that makes it very, very prevalent. 7 times more than deafness, 10 times more than physical disability. You see the list there on those bullet points, and I think it's quite remarkable. Every Labor Day, we come face-to-face with, because of the famous telethon, this thing called muscular dystrophy. And the fact of the matter is, the developmental disability, the particular one we know is mental retardation, 35 times more prevalent than muscular dystrophy. Which leads us to the question, what is it? Already you have heard me go back and forth between two terms. One is mental retardation, the other developmental disability. You've probably heard both of those. What's the difference? What is it? Developmental disability is a broader term. It has a federal definition, which I won't bore you with, but the fact of the matter is mental retardation and developmental disabilities are not two different names for the same thing. We tend to, even at Bethesda, we tend to use it that way. We talk about developmental disabilities and we use that term. It is far more common these days than mental retardation, but the technical fact of the matter is this. Developmental disabilities as a group contains more than just mental retardation. Also included in that group is cerebral palsy, a very different disability. Autism, or pervasive developmental disorder as it's sometimes known, another developmental disability. There was a time when epilepsy was considered a developmental disability, although the Epilepsy Foundation and some other advocacy groups are lobbying very hard to have that not be the case anymore. So it is a developmental disability, and it has a particular definition. The question, what is mental retardation? If you're going to answer that question, a lot of the answer depends on where and when you ask the question. Mental retardation is not something you can look at underneath a microscope and say, yep, there it is. It is, in fact, a set of criteria. The stuff you're going to hear about today was a set of criteria that was developed by an organization called the American Association on Mental Retardation. There's that term again, mental retardation. That group, AAMR, as it's sometimes known, is a very large professional organization in our field. And one of the things that they're going to be talking about at their national conference in May this year is, ought we to change our name? That term, mental retardation, has become a bit stigmatizing. The definition, though, is theirs. And if I've put it in this little box here, if you want to cut that out and put it in your wallet so that if anyone ever stops you on the street and says, hey, what's mental retardation, you'll be able to pull this out and tell them that mental retardation is characterized by significantly subaverage intellectual functioning, existing concurrently with deficits in two or more adaptive skill areas, and manifested under the age of 18. Well, there it is, clear as crystal. That's the definition. What's wrong with that? Well, one of the things that's wrong with that is not very plain English. So let's put that into some plain English, shall we? You could say this. In order to look at an individual and say, yep, that is a person who has mental retardation, three things have to be true. All three things have to be true. If two of them are true and one isn't, for example, it's not mental retardation. Maybe it's a disability that has a different name. Maybe it's no disability at all. But if you're going to say it's mental retardation, these three things have to be true. And you see them listed there at the bottom half of the sheet. The first part, significantly subaverage intellectual functioning. Well, how do we determine subaverage intellectual functioning? Well, historically, we've given IQ tests, still not all that unusual these days. It doesn't just say sub-average. Anybody know, by the way, what average IQ is? Nobody want to hazard a guess? Yeah. 100 on the button. You get an extra donut on the way out. The definition doesn't just say sub-average, however. It says significantly sub-average, and we're really, the definition as AAMR sees it these days, sees that as 70 to 75 or lower, two standard deviations from the mean for you graduate students. Second part of the definition, existing concurrently with deficits in two or more adaptive skill areas. Well, what in the world are those? You see them listed here. This is the group they go by, communication, self-care, home living, social skills, community use, et cetera, et cetera. There are some standardized tests that are used, and if you see a low IQ, along with deficits in two or more of those 10 adaptive skill areas, you're two-thirds of your way toward your criteria here. Third one says manifested under the age of, or before the age of 18. It says simply this. You look at an individual who has a developmental disability, and there is a normal course of development that people generally follow when they're growing up. In the case of people with this developmental disability we call mental retardation, we say simply this. Whatever went wrong in order to change the course of this person's development happened before their 18th birthday. Anything magic about an 18th birthday? Not particularly in terms of development. You have to draw the line somewhere. There are other definitions that draw the line much higher, 21, 22, and so on. This definition before the age of 18. So there you have it. Those are the three. Is it possible that someone can have two of these things be true and not the other? Absolutely. Happens all the time. Is it possible for you to have adaptive skill deficits as a result of something that happened before the age of 18, but not have an IQ score that's low and meet number one? Sure, absolutely. Cerebral palsy happens that way. Emotional behavioral disorders, what we sometimes know as emotional disturbance, can sometimes look that way. Is it possible for you to have a significantly sub-average IQ score because of something that happened before the age of 18, but not necessarily have deficits in those adaptive skill areas? Sure, that happens too. there's one woman that I know quite well. She works at the Watertown campus of Bethesda as a foster grandparent right now. Years upon years ago, she was someone we would have described as a Bethesda resident. And there literally was a day in her life when somebody from the county showed up at her door and sat down and had a meeting with her and announced to her that she didn't have mental retardation anymore. Imagine that. What happened? Did she grow out of it? Did she get cured? What happened? The definition changed. She used to be in. She wasn't in anymore. She talks about that pretty openly. There was only one reason, of course, for somebody from the county to be coming to her door and telling her this. She wasn't going to get money anymore. She rose above that, and it's kind of an interesting story. Wish I had more time. Is it possible for someone to have significantly subaverage intellectual functioning, existing concurrently with deficits and so on and so forth, but not manifested under the age of 18? Absolutely. If I were leaving here today and tragically got into a car accident, number one might be true, number two might be true, and in case you didn't notice by looking at me, number three is not going to be true. It's possible that I could have exactly the same IQ score and exactly the same deficits as someone involved in a car accident when they were 6 years old, but they would have a different name for their disability than I would. Does that strike you at all odd, that we would have the same kinds of needs, have what appears to be the same kind of disability, and yet have it go by two different names? Sometimes people question that. It's an important thing to keep in mind here that while it may look on the surface like two different disabilities, it's going to affect us in radically different ways. For me, it's going to mean a lot of rehabilitation and so on and so forth. But for the six-year-old child who might be involved in an automobile accident, it means that they've got a lot of development left that they're now going to have to get through, having this injury and all of its effects piled on top of it. A developmental disability isn't called a developmental disability just because it happens during someone's development. It's called a developmental disability because it is a disability that happens to someone's development. And that's what makes it different. That's why it's carved out that way. Okay, in a couple of minutes that I have left, where does this come from? What causes mental retardation? If you'll flip that sheet over, we could spend a semester on this. I'll do it in 2 minutes. There are over 300 known causes of mental retardation. I've split them up into 9 or 10 general categories. There are lots of ways to do this. I simply prefer this. These are not listed necessarily in any particular order of prevalence or important. Generally, I think it's probably fair to say that the ones near the top of the list tend to be a little more common than the ones near the bottom of the list, but that's not necessarily true. Infections such as rubella, sometimes called German measles, even though it's neither measles nor German. Spinal meningitis, if left untreated, can cause that. Intoxications or poisonings, such as lead poisoning, such as fetal alcohol syndrome. Injuries, such as car accidents, such as child abuse. Something called disorders of metabolism, growth, or nutrition. They happen in two ways in that category. Either people don't get enough to eat, or they get the right kinds of things to eat, but their body doesn't do the right sort of things with the food that they eat. Gestational problems like premature birth, environmental causes like deprivation or neglect. While that tends to cause fairly mild versions of mental retardation, it is still a bona fide cause. Chromosome changes like Down syndrome, which probably everyone has heard of, and Fragile X syndrome, which probably far fewer people have heard of. Fragile X is I listed it here because it's an example. Well, first of all, it's the second most common after Down syndrome, but secondly, it is it's one of those odd things that only happens to men. Women may carry the makings of it, but in fact, it's only manifest in men. That happens every once in a while in this field. Sometimes you run into ones that only happen to young women, like Rett syndrome and others. Congenital malformation, stuff just doesn't happen right. Brain diseases, fairly rare, but when they happen, they tend to be to have a profound effect on people. Number 10 is important to consider. That's the unknown category. If you took all of the causes in number 1 through number 9 and combined them, they would not be as large as number 10. The fact of the matter is, more than half of the time, we have absolutely no idea what has caused this. Prevalence of mental retardation by location, I put this on just for your interest. Keep in mind, it's really hard in some of these locations to come up with those numbers, and they all assume that we're taking our own definition to apply here. But if you're wondering about those huge numbers in Africa and Asia, you need to look at number four. The fact is, people aren't getting enough food to eat. So, anyway. Sometimes people say, what can we do to prevent mental retardation? The knee-jerk response is to look toward all sorts of glamorous genetic causes and that sort of thing. Let me lay this one on you as pastors entering into the world. The two fastest growing causes of mental retardation in the United States are fetal alcohol syndrome and child abuse. 100% preventable. Medical breakthroughs are nice, but the fact of the matter is, if we really want to change things, we need to stop poisoning and beating up our kids. It is sad, it is nonetheless true. Okay, I'm going to shut up. Earl's going to take over, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, Dave. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all the Bible passages that I was going to present. You have them in the outline. I was going to have mini sermons because I went to seminary to learn how to preach, and I was going to show you that I could actually do that. I want to point out a couple of them, however. Romans 3:23, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." I chose that because I, in recent weeks, have read some articles by people from the Reform background who say people with significant developmental disabilities never reach the age of accountability, so they should not be baptized, they should not participate in the Lord's Supper, they cannot understand the Word of God, so we pray that God will have pity on them and they will get to heaven. That is not so. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And that is why I give thanks for our Lutheran theology that says all are baptized. And baptism is the origin of faith because it gives the gift of the Holy Spirit, which gives the gift of faith. The practical application of that is the fact that if people with developmental disabilities are never really sinful, they're never really saved. They are never fully human. They are set aside. People with developmental disabilities are God's creation. They are not set aside. They don't go to limbo. They go to heaven or hell because they are people who sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The essential nature of ministry to and with people with developmental disabilities is based on the fact that we must reach out to them with the good news so that they can be our brothers and sisters in faith. We can't ignore it. It's not a nice thing to do. It is critical for us as the church to reach out to people with developmental disabilities. Matthew 28:19, teaching. People with developmental disabilities can and do learn at the level of which they are capable. It is important that we not say, oh, it's okay, they've been baptized. They are God's creatures whom we are called to teach. And when we're teaching them, it's important that we learn how to teach them instead of expecting them to understand what we're trying to say. I read an article, several articles, by a man by the name of Robert Persky. He was a chaplain for people with developmental disabilities in Kansas in the 60s and 70s. And he had the phenomenal insight that maybe with people with developmental disabilities, it is not so much that they can't learn as we can't teach. It is critical that we learn how to communicate with people with developmental disabilities in a way and in styles of teaching that enable them to learn and to understand at the best possible level that they can. It is not necessary that one memorize Luther's Small Catechism to be able to go to the Lord's Supper either. it is that one is able to discern the body and blood of Christ. We at Bethesda have learned over the years that people understand a lot more than we sometimes think. It is, again, our need to understand how they can communicate with us the faith that they have, whether it's verbal or through motions or through picture boards or through cards that demonstrate their knowledge and understanding. It is critical that we do it. It is critical that pastors of congregations support and enhance that ministry, not necessarily always doing it because it is time and labor intensive, but it is essential that we support those kinds of instructions in ministries. One other peccadillo from that same article I read about the people from the Reformed way of thought. They talked about the least of these, my brothers, when Jesus was separating the sheep and the goats. Often today, people with developmental disabilities are referred to as the least of these. They're kind of like eternal children that we ought to take care of. As a matter of fact, they said we ought to provide instruction for people with developmental disabilities like we would our children. People with developmental disabilities do grow up. They are adults. They are adults with developmental disabilities. They are not eternal children. It has to do with how we teach and interact and give respect and dignity to people. Adults are deserving of dignity and respect. They are God's beautiful creatures. They are not mistakes. They're not accidents. They are God's people. They are not deserving of pity. They are deserving of respect and appropriate interaction and supports. I looked up in Lenski's commentary on the least of these. He talks about people being perceived by society as the least of these. They are not the least of Christ's brothers. They are not the least of his creation. He says that Jesus used this so that we would understand that all people are to be loved and supported when they are in need or when there are issues in their life, whether they would be considered great by society or less by society. They are not less in God's eyes. They are not Christ's least brothers. It is important when we interact with people with disabilities that we treat them with mutual dignity and respect. Have any of you had interactions or relationships with people with developmental disabilities? Yeah. Do you understand then how it is important for everyone else to understand that it is a mutual relationship with a person with developmental disabilities? We get as much as we give. We are loved as much as we love. One of my favorite people at the church where I go, which is St. Paul's in Oconomowoc, is Matt. Matt is a man with Down syndrome. I know that every Sunday that I go to St. Paul's in Oconomowoc and I see Matt, I will have a hug. Matt and I have become friends. We have a mutual relationship of respect. He is an important person to me as I am an important person to him. And that's a mutual relationship. Growth in faith. I mentioned before that people with developmental disabilities can and do grow in faith. But first and foremost, faith is not knowledge. Faith is transformation. People with developmental disabilities are transformed from people who are against Christ to people who follow Christ. Following that, they can and do learn. As I said as well, it is important for us to learn how to teach. And it does take work. We cannot use some of the big words we learned at seminary. We need to learn to explain to people what those big words mean. That might even help with our communication with other people in the congregation as well. We talk a lot about inclusion these days, or in mainstreaming. One size does not fit all. When we talk about inclusion, that's the goal, I would guess, for all of us to be fully included in society, is the same for people with developmental disabilities. when we're including people in the life of the congregation, it is important that we understand who the person is, what is most appropriate for that person at that time in that situation. Perhaps the Sunday school class is a segregated class because the people with developmental disabilities are in need of a class at that point. Perhaps it is that there is one person in the Sunday school has developmental disabilities, and they're mainstreamed with children their own age. It might be that that person would stay in that class for 2 or 3 years until he or she is able to learn. But it is important not to try to fit everybody into the same can, but to devise programs and supports that are appropriate to the people. We should not preclude that any of the answers, but talk with people, talk with the people who support them, talk with their parents. Inclusion in the church is more than just letting people in the door. Sometimes people allow people with developmental disabilities into the congregation as long as they sit in the back left pew and they behave themselves and don't cause any trouble. Sometimes they allow people in the congregation and they can come to the fellowship meal as long as they don't eat all the food. Inclusion is treating people with dignity and respect and encouraging them to be full members in the life of the congregation. In November of 2001, Bethesda was privileged to give a Christian Service for Volunteers award to Lydia and Cora. Lydia and Cora were honored for their more than 20 years as teachers' aides in the Sunday school program at St. Lawrence in Frankenmuth. Lydia and Cora were volunteers throughout the community of Frankenmuth and were great representatives of the fact that people with developmental disabilities have a great deal to give and they are important to the community and to the Christian community. Lydia and Cora live in our group home in Frankenmuth. It was the first time we gave an award to people whom we support. I hope it is not the last time. Lydia and Cora have a great deal to give the church and to teach us. Support for inclusion is important. We at Bethesda understand that you have a lot to do. You have a lot to learn. You aren't necessarily going to know about all the programs and services for people with developmental disabilities. In 11 states, we have people called parish ministry consultants who help congregations, families, individuals with developmental disabilities have a full, complete life in the congregation. They help pastors learn to teach. They help lay people to learn to teach. They help developmental disabilities and other disability support groups get started in congregations. And they're willing to be of service. You have our phone number on some of our materials. Give us a call, and we're more than willing to help congregations, to help individuals, include people with developmental disabilities. It is a critical, essential ministry of the church. Most of the time, you're not going to run into people from group homes coming to your congregation. You are going to run into families. Families that are members of your congregation. Their child was born with Down syndrome. The child was born with some developmental disability and they have no idea why that child was born that way. They are brokenhearted. They cry for the child. They cry for themselves. They cry for broken and shattered dreams. And they have a future that is very clouded because they don't know what it's going to look like for them or for their child. And they need a pastor. You aren't going to be able to take away the pain. You aren't going to be able to take away the suffering. But you can walk with them and let them know that God is with them in the midst of all of this. And to help them go through difficult times and struggles, to go through uncertainty, to help them learn how to answer questions and make important decisions. You as a pastor, you as a layperson, have an important thing to give. You have God's love to give them. 7.5 years ago, my wife and I we're proud to, what, 7 years ago, last month, we were proud to be present at our daughter's birth. She's 7 years old, and Abraham and Sarah were mentioned by several people when we had a child of that, at that point. When we learned that we were pregnant, we learned there was also a chance that she was going to be born with Down syndrome. It was a tremendous shock to be almost 50 years old and going to have a baby, and also to understand the child might have developmental disabilities. We went through a lot of questioning, a lot of soul searching, a lot of uncertainty because we didn't know what the future was going to bring. By God's grace, Angela Joy did not have Down syndrome, but she got the name before we knew that she was going to be a healthy, normal child. We decided that she would have been a messenger of joy no matter how she was born, no matter her mental acuity. That was a brave thing for me to say at that time because I was still months away before she was going to be born. And perhaps if God had pity on me because I may not have been strong enough to handle it as well as others do, perhaps I would have failed in my wondering how I was going to raise a child with Down syndrome. I didn't have to answer the question. Many others do, and they need our help and support. And people with developmental disabilities need to be included in the life of the church. And we are here to support. Larry said, 11:30, no later. It is 11:29. Room for one question.
What are some common errors that pastors make in ministering to, thinking about ministry to and for developmentally disabled folk?
One is that children cannot learn. They can and do learn. The child can't communicate. We need to learn how to understand and read how the child communicates sometimes. If it doesn't happen quickly, it won't happen at all. With developmental delays like these, it isn't going to happen quickly. We go to seminary learning a lot of answers. This is not one where we have to be the shell answer man and know everything. We walk with people and we learn from them as much as we try to have them learn from us about how to be their pastor. Another thing, that we have people with significant disabilities going to church on Sunday mornings. Sometimes congregation members get upset because people with disabilities might make a noise at the wrong time. On occasion, they will say, well, you really ought to sit in the cry room. Mistake. They will never learn. Maybe they need to go somewhere else. Mistake. Sometimes we assume that people with disabilities can't improve on behaviors. They can. It takes a two-way street, however. With those who have significant disabilities and behaviors don't change, we love them and include them anyway and learn how to be more flexible. And don't forget, there's a whole mission field of millions of people with disabilities, 90% of whom are not in church on Sunday. A church that loves them loves everybody, and people will know about it.
Thanks.
Did you have, Dave, did you have anything you want to add to that?
No, it was brilliant and eloquent and succinct.
That's why I brought him
along. I would only say, I think a classic error is failing to realize the full potential of a life in the congregation. In other words, I think it's very common for pastors and congregations to say, how will we provide special education services? How will we provide support? How will we provide nurture? It is less common for pastors to say, What are all of the ways in which this person can be acolyte, greeter, usher? The list goes on and on depending on where your congregation is, but that's where you get the real, the knitting together.
Thanks so much. Thanks for coming today. Thanks. Would you join me in saying thank you?